Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. And today, a special thanks to the National Security Agency, apparently. Thanks for listening. I mean it. 140 million Verizon subscribers, a billion calls per day. There has to be some serious trash talking going on, right? I feel safer knowing that I'm an AT&T customer. People whose phone calls are boring, apparently innocuous, as I look at my AT&T bill, and this goes for you, Sprint and T-Mobile customers. I'm feeling a burst of patriotism. All those suspicious Verizon customers, on the other hand, what would we call them? Sleeper cell phones, I guess? But seriously, folks, let's begin with a look at this revelation of a vast and expanded domestic phone surveillance program by the Obama intelligence apparatus, surpassing apparently what was done under George W. Bush's administration. A court order obtained by the Guardian news organization seems to show a huge scale of domestic surveillance. The Obama administration has allowed the National Security Agency to look at virtually all of the call data on the Verizon network. The top secret order approved by a so-called FISA court under the revamped Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act confirms the Obama interest in a tactic of intelligence gathering the president once opposed as a candidate for the White House, but now seems to embrace, now that he's got his own situation. When we are joined now by James Bamford, one of the country's leading authorities on the NSA, author of several books, including The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. James, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks, John. I appreciate it.
Now, are you surprised by this, or on some level, and I'm reading between the lines in some of the reports, this is implied that this is a natural consequence of the changes that were put into the FISA Act and that we could have anticipated this sort of thing?
Well, I agree, and that was one of the problems with the FISA Amendments Act was that it basically legalized what George Bush had been doing in his warrantless eavesdropping program.
Why do you think, well, first of all, talk about the kinds of information that it looks like this court order has allowed the NSA to gather.
Well, this particular court order, and there probably are many other court orders that nobody has seen yet, but this particular court order, from looking at it, it orders Verizon to turn over all the call data internationally and domestically to the NSA. That means who's calling whom, what time the call is made, where the calls are being made from, all the data except for the actual content of the call.
So they're actually not listening, but they do know where the callers are because they can geolocate them using the network.
That's right. They can get all the data except for the actual conversations.
And let's try to contrast what George W. Bush did that was apparently unauthorized and listen to Barack Obama campaigning against these kinds of tactics back in 2008. First, here's George W. Bush's rationale for domestic surveillance.
We really need to know what they're saying. And we need to know what they're thinking. And we need to know who they're talking to.
So that was Bush's rationale. It seems that the scale of this surveillance suggests that the administration wants to essentially monitor every international call coming into the mobile network in the U.S.
Well, they did that under George Bush also, but I think under the Bush administration, they limited it to the international communications in and out of the United States. What this does is expand it dramatically. Nobody's ever gone this far in terms of watching every communication period, every communication in the United States or into or out of the United States.
Well, one of the things that's so unusual here is that it contrasts so sharply with the way President Obama, then candidate Obama, talked about this sort of thing back in 2008. Listen.
You know, if you start asking them questions about their intelligence activities, warrantless wiretaps, things like that, they won't, you know, you can forget it. I think it's very important to remember that this is a government of and by and for the people. And the only way you can hold us accountable is if you know what we're doing.
Now, there are a couple of interpretations here. I mean, the president may know something. He undoubtedly does know something that we don't. But is there also the possibility that anyone in the White House becomes a captive of the capabilities of the National Security Agency?
Well, most presidents do. That's the problem. And Obama became captive of the of the drone technology, and he's apparently gotten captive of NSA's technology. I mean, the NSA director right now is the most important intelligence official in the history of the country, basically. He's a four-star general. He's in charge of the largest intelligence agency on Earth and the most secret intelligence agency. So when you have that much secret power, it tends to go to your head sometimes.
And let's talk about the capabilities of the NSA. We've said here that, as far as we can tell from this court order, what Verizon is handing over to the U.S. government is called data, who called whom and when and where they are, because you can locate them based on their cell phone usage and what tower is being activated by the cell phone. But do they also have the capability to record the calls?
Yes, calls and also email, tweets, anything that's communicated. For example, the NSA, back a couple of years after 9/11, they built a very secret room inside the AT&T switch in San Francisco. This is a massive building. It's about 10 stories high. And they have a secret room there where all the communications, domestic or international, that comes through that switch, which handles much of the northwest part of the United States, is duplicated, and it's sent down to this secret little room where there's software that filters all this communications, telephone and email, and then picks out whatever the software is programmed to find. So if you have a telephone number that's programmed in there, or if you have a email, or your name happens to be on the watch list, whatever, if you're targeted in that on that software in that room, then your communications will be kicked out. And that's voice as well as data.
Do you think the American people are terribly concerned about this? Have we basically passed a point where there's ever going to be enough pushback to really restore the way things once were?
Well, I think there was a great deal of outrage over the warrantless eavesdropping, warrantless wiretapping program under the Bush administration. And I think each time this happens, there becomes less sensitivity to it, and it becomes more acceptable. We just have to wait and see if this has created outrage among the public or not. It should, because we're moving along a line that takes us to what George Orwell wrote about in his book 1984. I mean, we're basically surpassed that at this point. So, yeah, I think there should be great concern over this, because this is a massive expanding of where we were before we knew this.
1984. Now, there's a book that could use a sequel in our time. James Bamford is the author of The Shadow Factory, the ultra-secret NSA from 9/11 to the eavesdropping on America. Thanks so much, James.
I appreciate it, John.
Register your outrage if you can. Do you have a reaction to what we're learning from the Guardian News organization this morning about domestic surveillance of Verizon phone call data on the Verizon network? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. And now to the Middle East, and a battle for the frontier. Fighting between the Syrian government and opposition forces has made its way into the Golan Heights. The battle was over a border crossing between Syria and Israel, which occupies the Golan Heights. That border crossing has been monitored by the United Nations since 1974. Reporter Matthew Bell in Jerusalem Now recently traveled to the Golan Heights for PRI's The World, which is produced by our partner WGBH. Matthew Bell, welcome.
Good morning.
How much has this civil war in Syria intruded onto the Golan? We know about this border crossing, but it just in general, is the fighting close to the Golan Heights?
It's incredibly close. And the wild thing, John, is to go up there and stand on a couple of hilltops. And this is in the Israeli-controlled part of the Golan. And you just look down the hill and you can see Syria. Residents there told me stories about seeing shelling, explosions, even kind of watching, you know, tank battles over the last couple of years unfold. There's been a fair amount of fighting along that ceasefire line, which, as you said, has been controlled by these UN peacekeepers. But it's been very quiet. This is the other interesting thing about the place, is there are all these trenches and kind of old military detritus left over from the 1967 and 73 wars that Israel fought with Syria. But it's been really quiet for 45 years or so.
And that quiet can go away quickly, as we discovered in southern Lebanon when UN peacekeepers increasingly got involved in actual fighting during the instability in Lebanon, which caused all sorts of problems between Israel and that country. What is the position of the United Nations forces right now? Are they staying well back? Any indication that they might get involved, either inadvertently or otherwise?
The big news, John, is reports just coming out in the last hour or so that there's about 1,000 UN peacekeepers there along the ceasefire line between the Israeli Golan and Syria. 380 of them are from Austria, and the Austrians say they might be done. They might be finished. It's too dangerous. There have been several incidents of peacekeepers being kidnapped by rebel forces. They were released pretty soon after. But clearly, for many years, these guys have basically patrolled an area and prevented the Syrians and Israelis from going at each other again. It's been quiet, but just in the last year or so, it's become a lot more dangerous for them. And this is going to be very worrisome for Israel.
Finally, if there is a pullback by the United Nations, it's pretty clear that the Syrian government has an interest in maintaining the security of that border along traditional lines, yes?
Absolutely. And it's a big problem potentially for Syria as well. The understanding is that there are different rebel groups operating on the other side of that ceasefire line. You know, it's not clear who's in charge. For now, this was the big deal about today, is that this was the first time we got reports this morning that rebels actually took control on the Syrian side of the fence of that UN-controlled border crossing. So this was a pretty big deal. We've now since heard subsequent reports that Syrian government troops took it back. But this has got to be a worrisome thing, interestingly, for both the Israelis and the Syrian government.
He's based in Jerusalem. Matthew Bell is a Middle East correspondent for The World. He's just visited the Golan Heights, where fighting from the Syrian civil war is clearly evident there. Matthew Bell, thanks so much.
You're welcome, John.
The latest this morning, a border crossing in the Golan Heights has been traded back and forth between Syrian opposition forces and Syrian government forces. We've already been talking about a fierce battle on the Golan Heights over a border crossing, a battle between government Syrian forces and Syrian opposition forces. But how regional is this war? We've talked about it already, but what does this mean in the Golan Heights? Jeneb Abdo joins us, a fellow at the Stimson Center and a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. Jeneb, welcome.
Thank you very much.
The Golan Heights is a particularly troublesome zone for Syria in the sense that Bashar al-Assad really needs to keep that border secure. Are the opposition forces in a position to really disrupt things by making the Golan chaotic?
Yes, but I think that we've already seen much more problematic areas in the region where the opposition has created, you know, of course, along with Assad's forces, created a much broader sectarian war. This is no longer just a war in Syria. Syria is still sort of in the background. It's sort of the narrative driving both Shia and Sunni Muslims. But I think we're seeing now a conflict that is crossing borders among basically four countries: Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and Turkey. And of course, the Golan is part of that, but I think that what we're seeing in these other countries is much more serious and dangerous.
Let's take Iraq first. Some have described that there is essentially an uninterrupted path of instability from the Syrian border zone straight into Iraq, where sectarian conflicts in Iraq exactly mirror what's going on in Syria right now. Would you agree?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that even though we have been talking about this whole issue of a sectarian regional war in recent weeks, let's not forget, of course, that the sectarian war in Iraq started a long time ago after the U.S. invasion. So I think that this is why we have seen, to some degree, the great escalation. I mean, Syria began as just sort of a protest movement against Assad, but now there's a great and very important religious doctrinal dimension to the Shia-Sunni conflict.
Now, let me push you a little bit on that. Are you suggesting that a sort of final battle between Sunnis and Shia is possibly what's in the cards here, depending on how much wider this conflict gets?
I think there's the danger of that, and I don't want to exaggerate in any way, you know, what we might see in the future. But if you read a lot of the comments that come from both sides, and in fact, we don't, you know, not only are we seeing this among sort of the rank and file fighters, but if you look at, for example, if you compare the speeches that both Hassan Nasrallah made last week and Yusuf Qaradawi, who, of course, is the very, very influential sheikh in Doha, Qatar. They were basically talking to one another and responding to each other on this issue of sectarianism. And I think that what was so striking about both of their speeches, and, you know, of course, both of these clerics have millions of followers in the Middle East, if not around the world. But what was most striking is that they have basically cut the pretenses. They've stopped the pretenses of any sort of reconciliation that goes back centuries in this conflict between Shia and Sunni Muslims. And Qaradawi said, you know, I was very naive, he says, in fact, in thinking that there could be some sort of reconciliation. And so I think that to some degree he, and perhaps less so on Nasrallah's part, I wouldn't say effectively declared war on the Shia, but certainly he indicated that we are at a different phase now in the conflict than we were a few years ago.
Well, that's pretty alarming. Let's focus on Turkey for a moment, where there are many, many sort of nascent, quiet powder kegs that could be reopened by any number of unstable moments in the region. We're looking at some unrest that seems to be related to Prime Minister Erdogan's style of management. But I noticed that Syrian government officials were very quick to cackle about what's going on inside Turkey. What evidence is there that the Syrians would love to see instability take place inside Turkey right now?
Well, the Syrians, of course, I mean, the government of President Assad, of course, want revenge because Turkey has been very, very involved in taking in refugees and in aiding the opposition. So, of course, you know, they want revenge, and this is why perhaps they would like to see instability in Turkey. There have been, of course, there's now violence in Turkey as a direct spillover of what's been happening in Syria. So I think that of course there was always this great risk for the government of Turkey that if they did aid the opposition, if they did take in refugees as they have, that they would pay the consequences.
And of course, all of this is reflected in the instability and traditional instability in Lebanon, where there has been a sectarian divide since really the 1980s. And if we talk about Hezbollah being a proxy for Iran, and Hezbollah is engaged in battles with the Syrian opposition right now, what do you make of the scale of the conflict right now in Lebanon?
Well, again, unfortunately, Lebanon is now sort of at the epicenter of this conflict because of its proximity to Syria and, of course, because of the involvement of Hezbollah. And I think that if we try to examine what the causes are of this escalation in the sectarian conflict, the proxy war is sort of at the top of the list, or at least second in the list of causes, which also include, you know, even a perception divorced from what's on the ground, a perception among Shia and Sunni Muslims that they're fighting some sort of war. But going back to the issue of Hezbollah, I mean, I think that we are seeing the intensification of this proxy war with Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia on one side, to some degree the United States, and on the other, a real intensification of what has historically been the Hezbollah-Iran-Syria axis. And they are fighting on the Iran-Hezbollah-Syria side. They are fighting for survival. And I think it's very important to understand this. For them, this isn't just a war for power. It's a war for survival. Mm.
A threshold moment for many of the players here
for
in
Hezbollah
Syria.
For Syria.
Certainly. Genev Abdo is a fellow with the Middle East Southwest Asia program at Stimson, and also is a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution, talking about Syria. Genev, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
sitting at a red light, minding my own business. Next thing you know, I heard a rumble and a building and a sign fall on my truck.
We was laying roof. We heard a big bang, explosion or whatever. We looked over, everything was collapsed. We ran down, everybody ran down, and we went in there and we started pulling people out.
12 were almost immediately taken to the hospital. A 13th person was buried under debris for 2 hours.
They heard her voice. They gave her water. She drank water. We're very, very happy about the rescue.
We will now confirm that there are 6 people who died. 1 man and 5 women.
It's a dangerous environment for our members, firefighters, our paramedics. We're going to take our time.
Tragic story in Philadelphia, 13 hours after a 4-story building collapsed in central Philly. A woman was found alive in the rubble. 6 people died, as we mentioned, more than a dozen injured in yesterday's collapse. The 4-story building was in the process of being demolished when one of its walls suddenly gave way. Bricks, wood, concrete, cinder blocks fell onto a store next door. Joining me now, Elizabeth Fiedler, a reporter at WHYY, a public radio station in Philadelphia. Elizabeth, what's the feeling this morning?
Definitely a somber feeling this morning. As you mentioned, there was a woman who was pulled quite miraculously from the rubble late last night, more than 12 hours after the building collapsed. And so a lot of people here are waking up and are going throughout their routine today and are just talking about the fact that it is a miracle that a woman was pulled out of the rubble, out of what looked like quite a terrible scene, at 12 hours after the collapse.
Certainly this is a day of grieving, but is this a day of reflection on regulations for demolitions taking place in the dense center city of a place like Philadelphia?
There are absolutely a lot of outstanding questions today. I was out at the scene all day yesterday just after the collapse, and a lot of people who live and work near the building said they watched the demolition. Something about it didn't seem quite right. They were surprised the thrift store was still operational right next door while this major, massive demolition was happening. Also, some questions about the contractor who was hired for this process, and the mayor last night in a press conference, the mayor declined to talk too much about those things, said there will be a full investigation by the city, by OSHA, make sure all of the proper, permits were acquired, all the regulations were followed. And, you know, we'll see if there was something that could have prevented this tragedy or if perhaps they will implement new regulations.
Broadly speaking, this is a real setback for Philadelphia, which has dealt with crumbling infrastructure in years past, but has really mobilized in recent years an effort to get control of things. How much of a setback do you think this is?
You know, I saw someone had posted a comment, I believe it was on a story last night, saying Philly has a lot of old buildings. Think about just how old this brick was and how many bricks of approximately that age are around the city. We are a city that is quite proud of our history, but that does, as you mentioned, come with old buildings, challenges with older infrastructure, things like that. And certainly as we revitalize, as we push to renovate old buildings downtown, this is something that we're going to have to deal with. And, you know, I think it's going to come out in the investigations exactly, you know, whether this was preventable or, if maybe there are other steps that we should take in the future.
For this week, there's going to be disruptions in central Philly if you're trying to pass through there, yes?
Yes, and I was there not too many hours ago, and streets still blocked off. It's an investigation is underway, and 6 people died, and this will, take a while. The mayor last night was, urging the media to remember that 6 people perished and that there will be a major investigation. So definitely snarling, traffic and, just sort of getting people to stop, I guess, as they pass by on their commutes, on their daily routines. And it's really quite a remarkable sight, this huge pile of bricks and rubble. It's hard to believe a building stood there not long ago.
6 people died, more than a dozen injured in a collapse of a 4-story building. Reporting for us, Elizabeth Fiedler, a reporter at WHYY. Thanks so much, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me.
For medical students, these are the miraculous days.
It's a great day. It's a lot of excitement, not just for me, but for everyone else in the class. I mean, this is where we find out where we're going for the next few years. This is where we find out what kind of doctor we're going to be. This is everything we worked for.
Those are med students at the University of Maryland. But everywhere in the U.S., medical students applying for clinical residency are learning their match, what hospital will take them for what will be the hardest work they have ever done in the most competitive environment they've ever experienced. The transition from classroom to clinical is the tough act of medical school. Being good at one does not make you good at the other. And that's what we want to discuss today with Dr. Danielle Ofri, who's an associate professor of medicine at NYU School of Medicine. Her newest book, What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine, is in stores this week. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us is Rachel Randall, who just graduated from medical school last month. Rachel, how you doing?
I'm good. Thank you.
So have you figured out your match, and what was your match day like?
Match day was very exciting. It was a lot of anxiety, and I think that all of us were pretty happy whenever you finally found out that it paid off.
And you're going to be doing your residency in the Baltimore area. Do you think you're prepared to do that for the challenges ahead dealing with patients?
I think so. I think that you have to just jump in and face it. And the learning curve is steep. That's what we keep getting told. So.
And your specialty?
Family medicine.
Dr. Ofri, the medical educational system has a real problem with this transition from the classroom to the clinical. How do you see it?
Well, I think that in the classroom, we have a very clear curriculum, certain guidelines. But once students get out into the clinical world, the human condition is much more chaotic and not as amenable to a structured educational system. So students are very much at the whim of randomness, who their patients are, who their attendings, who their residents are. And there's very much a hidden curriculum of what it's really like to be a doctor. And much of what they learned about professionalism seems to fall by the wayside when they're in the actual world of medicine.
Does emotion get strained out of the medical student in traditional American medical education?
Well, it gets shaken up a lot. And I think when medical students walk onto the wards, they feel suddenly so useless. They're used to being smart and on the ball, and now suddenly they're at the bottom of the totem pole with no skills, life and death swirling around them, and they're at a loss.
Rachel, do you have that uselessness problem when you get on the clinical floor? Are you worried about it? Is that some of your anxiety?
I definitely feel as though third year when you start clinicals, there was a lot of that. You're thrown into these situations that you read about in books, but in practice you seem to be floundering and just hoping that some resident tells you what to do so that you can actually, make yourself useful in some way.
Rachel, did you get the impression that floundering was intentional, that it's almost a form of hazing?
No, I mean, it's more a product of the system rather than a hazing. Without the experience, you don't know what you're doing, so you just have to fight your way in to get that experience.
We've always done it this way, so therefore we will continue to do it this way. Dr. Ofri, how are medical schools beginning to anticipate some of the problems that you've identified and changing things around a little bit?
Well, research has shown that medical students enter medical school with all the ideals we want in a doctor: empathy, professionalism, caring. And that many of these are eroded during medical school. And it seems to happen in that crucial third year. So I think medical schools are taking notice and beginning to realize that students need consistent mentoring. They can't be serially disrupted every 4 weeks being thrown into a new place. So, for example, at NYU, they're working to extend the clinical experience, started earlier, have intercession times where students can reflect on these experiences. Other medical schools are dispensing with the monthly rotations and trying to make one integrated clerkship over the course of a longer period so students can have a long-term relationship with mentors and with patients.
Did you feel, Rachel, when you went into the clinical setting that patients themselves, actual human patients, were what you knew the least about, even though you knew a lot about cells and, endocrine systems, that whole thing?
I think that a lot of students, especially those who have come directly from undergraduate into medical school, haven't worked with the public. And there's definitely, something to be said about the human element. You can't negate that. On paper, pathologies are a lot different than when they're in a person.
One of our listeners talking about his experiences, John Quinn, says you certainly don't go to medical school to learn empathy. That should have been learned and internalized much earlier than that. Do you think medical schools have a responsibility to maybe be a little more on the ball regarding empathy?
Well, I do agree that our students come in with empathy. I don't think we need to teach it, but we do need to preserve it.
And you can't do that preserving in a classroom or with a PowerPoint slide. And what it takes is the mentors modeling that. So the interns, residents, nurses, and doctors that the students see are showing that. And by walking the walk rather than just talking the talk, I think that's our biggest chance to preserve what the students come in with.
Listener Paul Lutz, describing the third year of medical school, says at that point you've sort of committed everything, and having invested so much in time, money, and emotion into becoming a doctor, pressing forward is the only viable option, even if the clinical setting doesn't match your childhood dream job. Rachel, did you get a rude awakening? Was it still a dream job being a doctor when you walked onto the floors?
There is a part of the experience that's jarring. You know, the reality doesn't quite match up with what you expected because you're working with people and each patient you have is going to be different. Not every patient is going to be 100% appreciative of what you're doing. You're going to have people that, you know, don't actually want to help. You know, they don't want to help themselves and it's hard to help them at times. And it's, you know, just anytime you're working with people that are making their own choices and they might not go home and take those medications that you're giving them and you realize that it's not quite what you thought it would be.
Rachel Randall is a family practice doctor who will start her residency in Baltimore a little later this year. Rachel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Offrey, take us out. What's the fix here? Is there a particular sort of element of the curriculum, a manifesto in med school that's going to warn students about some of these jarring issues and maybe insert more emotion and empathy into the classroom itself?
Well, there is no easy fix. However, I think the idea that it's on our radar, that this is as important as learning pathophysiology, that it's up there with anatomy, is the first step. And that on day one, we begin talking about how crucial this is, letting students meet patients in the beginning and making sure that our mentors and leaders are modeling and demonstrating, you know, what it means to be a doctor beyond just knowing the diseases.
Dr. Danielle Offrey is Associate Professor of Medicine at NYU School of Medicine. Her newest book, What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine, is in stores this week. Doctor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You know, here's a head-scratcher. I want to leave you with this hour. Arianna Huffington, right? You'd think that the pundit, become publisher, successful author, and founder of the Huffington Post, an empire that has been gobbling up traditional media for years, I mean, you'd think she would know when to stop, would know the definition of success. Well, today in New York, the HuffPo is sponsoring a conference called The Third Metric, Redefining Success Beyond Money and Power. I guess if you already have money and power, you need a new definition of success. All of this is just an excuse for us to talk to Susie Essman, actress, writer, television producer, voice artist, star of HBO's Curb Your Enthusiasm. And first of all, welcome.
What is a metric?
What is a metric? I'm looking at it right here.
The third metric is because Arianna grew up in Europe where they still use the metric system. To us, it's Greek. We don't know what the metric system is.
It's all Greek to Arianna,
exactly.
Right? Isn't that the case? But you are on a panel later today called Leaning In and Leaning Back. And you are going to talk about what?
I'm going to talk about standing up because enough with this leaning. You know, I think the whole point of the conference is really about women finding another way to become successful and powerful and happy and healthy, and that the idea of following the male version of it has just made people incredibly stressed out and it hasn't really worked for anybody. So I don't know that there's an answer, but I think the conference is about exploring it. And in my own experience as a stand-up comic, I find that women are generally uncomfortable with their own power.
Hmm.
I went to see a whole bunch of young comedians recently, 26 in a row. Put a gun to my head. But it was interesting because what I noticed about the women, who many of them were very funny, they were apologizing for the material. They weren't owning their material. They were and I pointed it out to my husband. He's like, yeah, you're right. Whereas the guys,
they're swaggering, right?
Swaggering, and whether they were funny or not. And I've been watching this for 30 years. July will be 30 years that I've been doing stand-up. So I've been watching this for a long time. And I think having three daughters, 19, 22, and 23, I think that women owning their power is still a problem. And I don't know why.
Confident guys who think they're really funny and laugh at all their own jokes. Imagine that. We call that car talk here on Public Radio.
That's funny.
So this is woman themed in a sense,
yes.
But I have to say, you know, with all these references to the male notions of success, I wish somebody had told me what that was. I think in today's world, even for me, I don't quite understand what the male definition of success is.
You know what,
is.
Though, John? That makes me always wonder if this is really more a class issue than a gender issue. You know, if there's the privileged and the entitled versus the rest of us.
Let me think. You know, did you know that let me just point this out here. The cocktail hour between 7 and 8 tonight is by Dom Perignon.
Yeah, there you go.
You think this is a class thing? I don't know.
But I just, you know, I mean, there's so many distinctions of gender and race. And I think that we forget about, well, we obviously didn't forget about it the last election. It was front and foremost. But I think that privilege and class is really the distinction between that.
Well, you know, part of this, I think, is a consequence of the economic divide in the United States.
Yeah.
In that people who are successful in the media world, in the political world, in the financial world, are in such a bubble
right.
that you can understand that they wouldn't know where to stop because they don't really interact with the rest of the world, the world of humanity. Because a lot of people, I think, who are not in that world just kind of go, chill out, have a life, for heaven's sake.
You know, I live upstate New York, which is really different. And that's my primary residence. And people, you know, a lot of women, I'm just saying the obvious, they're paycheck to paycheck, single mothers, you know, there's no time for leaning in or out or sideways.
But people do have a life.
They do have a life.
And they go to church and they have a spiritual understanding.
And they go to yoga class right. and they go to the gym and they, you know, all these things that taking care of themselves. And they raise their children, and they're fine.
You know, one of the sessions here is at the end of the day. It's called Do Men Get It? And it's Mika Brzezinski and a bunch of guys, including her co-host, Joe Scarborough. I mean, is that a wrestling match, or is that going to be actual discussion?
I don't know. I'll be gone by then.
right. In a sense,
but I think, you know, I think all of these kinds of conferences are great because I think that a lot of people have a lot of ideas. I have different ideas than people. And, you know, let's just air them all. And maybe these are the powerful people. These are the media people and the powerful people that can get messages across. And media makes a difference in people's lives. There is a trickle down.
And I think, you know, Oprah actually is mm-hmm. the sort of character behind the scenes here who really started – say what you want about Oprah. She really – inaugurated, I think, in our time, this idea that if you really want to have a quality of life, you have to be self-conscious
right.
about what it is you're doing. You have
and
to choose
things.
And
she got people
things.
To read.
Yeah, well, that's true.
She got people to read. You know, that's in my life, that's been an enormous thing, reading. But I was brought up with books in the house. You know, so people weren't. She got people to be aware of that, which I think is one of her greatest contributions.
And I think success in that context is having a rich intellectual life. Use your mind. Use your body. Make sure that all of the qualities of your life are you know, exercised fully in some sense. Don't just live in a career.
Right. I think that is what Ariane is saying here.
But she's a workaholic.
Yes.
I mean, she's the worst.
But I think that's just her personality, and she tries to sleep so and not have her BlackBerry. It's all about her. Yeah.
So we're all going to hug Ariana at this conference cigar.
But I think that she has valid points. You know, we are a sleep-deprived nation, which is problematic.
That's true. That is true.
We are way stressed out, and, you know, we are unhealthy in our food choices. You know, all these kinds of things which do make a difference in your life. My whole thing with my daughters has always been, you know, somebody said to me once in my stand-up, I'm the queen of making them come to me. And that's always been my philosophy is I'm just going about my business. You come to me. I'm not leaning in. I'm not bending backwards. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. You come to me.
All of which is a way of saying you can probably write this event off today here in New York because I suspect you're going to be getting some stand-up material at this conference. Am I right, maybe?
I hope so.
Possibly a Curb Your Enthusiasm episode or two.
That would be prime Larry Curb Your Enthusiasm episode to walk into a conference on women's issues and just completely say the wrong thing.
Yeah, he would be at the Do Men Get It? And he'd probably raise his hand and just say, no, I don't.
Well, he already thinks women are a complete mystery.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
And he's got the track record.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Susie Essman, actress, writer, television producer, voice artist, star of Curb Your Enthusiasm, and panelist at the third metric conference right here in New York. Susie, it's always great to talk to you.
Thank you, John.
Thanks so much. So the Obama administration's phone surveillance program, it's not a joke, folks, and it's got you talking.
This is Yvette from Miami, Florida, and I am really upset with the whole idea of the government being able to listen in, having grown up for part of my life in a military dictatorship in Cuba and then coming here and knowing that the government was always listening when we were talking to our family members.
We always want to hear from you. Give us a call. Tell us a story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tweet us at The Takeaway or just reach us on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway. React to our first story this morning, that is the surveillance of the Verizon phone network by the Obama administration. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or give us your definition of success. What's your third metric? Thanks so much for listening. And you too, NSA. I'm out for a day. Todd Zwillick will look after things tomorrow. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.